This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, Mitan Chung Han. It's a Monday.
Hey, Monday.
Are you in the grips of a Monday blues?
Yes, very much. Okay. I'm trying to mask it as best I can.
And you're doing a very good job of it, too.
Why, thank you, Sharad.
See, that lilt in your voice suggesting deep enthusiasm for the next 5 days, you know, excitement about the possibilities. Of course, we're going into a long weekend.
That's
that
right.
Should get everybody excited because the 5 days of work is going to be followed by 4 days of rest, except if you're, you know, doing open house and all that kind of stuff, which is actually a lot of hard work, don't you think?
Well, yeah, it is. No, but still, I'm sure our Muslim listeners will take that over and say 2 more days of work anytime, right? So I would rather enjoy Raya and the responsibilities that are associated with that affair.
I wouldn't presume to speak for people who have to do an open house, because I remember as a young person, what Christmas open houses were like for us as kids, kind of like, you know, running around doing things. It was tough, you know, because you had a constant stream of people. You didn't know when people were going to turn up, and you had to constantly fill, you know, the dishes and the plates, and there's always an uncle and aunt or, you know, a mom and dad sort of telling you to do this and that. Don't you remember it being really annoying because you'd had to get up early and just kind of help out?
Yeah, I guess so, but that would go against the entire spirit of having an open house to begin with, right? Instead of having that quality time with friends and family whom you normally won't have the luxury of just, you know, chilling with, you're then having to busy yourself, like you said, refilling the dishes and whatnot.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you know,
kind of defeats the purpose, I think.
You know what's interesting? I mean, I just say that I think it's very important. I love the open house culture that we've had for decades, but I do think, and I suspect strongly, that it's diminishing, because every time Chinese New Year comes around and I'm, you know, people say, well, I just think of myself, who's having an open house? And then so many people are not even in town. Everybody's decided that, you know, now everybody can miss the open house and fly off to someplace.
At least that's what they tell you, Sharad.
Ooh, ouch, that hurt. Okay, speaking of hurt, the siege of Marawi City in the Philippines enters its fifth week, and I think perhaps we didn't expect it to last so long. Mm. And the fact that it has, I think, is a cause for deep concern. We know that analysts have all weighed in on this. The fact that the Islamic State in southern Philippines has made such gains, the question really is whether the Filipino army is up to the task of defeating them. Also, in Mali, 2 people have died and over 30 who were held hostage have been freed in a militant attack on a tourist resort that happened overnight. Also overnight, France's Emmanuel Macron is headed for a landslide victory. We're going to be speaking to French observer of French politics later on after the 8:30 bulletin. Also, devastating fires in Portugal have claimed dozens of lives. I think over 60 now have perished. Many of them were in their cars as they tried to flee the fires.
Yeah, and going back to the French election story, some of the headlines now have Marine Le Pen, right? Her retaining her seat in the French Assembly, you know, so that salvages her political career, you know, after that loss in the presidential election.
Yeah, but you know, in the first round, her party suffered quite badly. In fact, all other mainstream parties.
The National Front.
Yeah, National Front. And the other mainstream parties, the Socialist Party, have all suffered massively because the Assembly is said of, you know, slightly under 600 seats is going to be filled to the brim with Le Public En Marche. So that's Macron's party, full of new people, most of them first-timers, also many of them women. And we see that also movement for women in the British elections recently. So very interesting on that score.
Yeah, and, you know, given these kind of developments now, you know, makes you wonder all that noise about the French exit from the EU, you know, should Le Pen have won, right? You know, there were plenty of fears and concerns about it. But when you see these kind of results, you know, in favor of Macron, right, makes you wonder, was it just a whole lot of noise?
Well, I think it's a whole lot of alarm, for sure. But we'll be back with more on that. Now it's time for Cream and White Room, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Cream and a White Room. I'm Sharad Kutan with me, Tan Chung Han. And the morning run continues to be part of the morning stretch before you get into your own. You kind of warm up the muscles by stretching. Though I believe there's a dispute over whether this should happen after that. In fact, stretching before you had done the exercise mm-hmm. is actually could be damaging to your muscles, but I'm no expert in this, but still I'll weigh in.
Yeah, well, I've heard the same thing as well, where apparently because if your muscles have been stationary and they are cold, so to speak, like you don't want to be stretching them as opposed to, say, doing some, you know, light movements and warming up, then only stretching.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So you see, you've read the same article that I have, at least one of them. Okay, in fact, you know, this is the wonderful thing about, you know, the public sphere in Malaysia, because, you know, for us who kind of operate in the English language, we often share a lot of materials together. We're probably all reading the story of the ongoing 1MDB saga. But there are many ways to skin that cat. And, you know, one of the things I've been impressed by, Han, is in the allegations, and among the allegations and the attempted seizures by the U.S. Department of Justice, has been a lot of artwork, really high-end artwork. Just a couple of months ago, we had Monet's were involved. Today, or more recently, I think last week, Pablo Picasso as well, which, of course, you know, Pablo Picasso is a Spanish painter coming from the earlier part of the 20th century. Also, Diane Arbus, kind of post-war American photographer. Both of these artworks, Diane Arbus's work was called Boy with the Toy Hand Grenade. You can always Google that to get the image, or I might try to do that for all of you and put it on Twitter. Pablo Picasso's, and I'm going to try and pronounce this French title, Nature morte en coin de trois.
Wow.
Oh, I know.
I have no idea what that means.
Neither do I. Sounds except French. I'm looking at the image right now, and it includes a skull of a dead animal. So I think morte, I believe, is dead. It's for death. It's the French word for death, I believe. Anyway, there you have it. My question is, when it comes to art, I mean, would you ever consider, Han, buying art for a friend?
Well, obviously, the big caveat here is that I do not lay any claim in order to have any ties with this ultra high end of society. I mean, I can't imagine trying to plonk down, you know, millions on a single art piece, right? Obviously, Jolo and friends have have much, much deeper pockets.
They're in a different league.
Right? Yeah, okay. I mean, there's stratosphere, right? Yeah. But then, I mean, I guess if I had the means, I would. But obviously, for somebody like me, and I think I dare say for, you know, many I think just most average Malaysians, like, you would have to cultivate that interest to begin with, though, you know?
Yeah, right. So, but what about the other person? So you're kind of basic, you know what you could buy for yourself because you cultivate an interest and you have a sense of it. But buying something, okay, let's put it for this, let's kind of dial it down in terms of how classy the object is. Just, you know, have you ever had somebody buy you a poster for the wall, you know, so a nice saying or some one of those kinds of things? Have you ever looked at those gifts and said, oh my God, I wish they hadn't, because I won't put this on my wall, and how will I explain the fact that I won't put this on my wall?
Okay, well, I mean, I have gone through a couple of junkyard sales and got a few couple of posters for myself as well. Yeah, sure. But
you mean you think they were previously gifts that were tossed off?
It was good enough for me. But back to your original question of whether I would buy. Again, it would have to come from a place where I can appreciate the art and I know what it would mean for the recipient or the potential recipient. But obviously, I'm not quite there yet. Are you there?
Well, I don't buy art for other people. When I say I buy art, I mean anything under 1,000 ringgit, you know. Over the last 22 years, I have been buying art.
Really?
I mean, yeah, and I go to, you know, art galleries or usually the ones that feature young artists. And I'm so glad that many of the young artists I bought then have now become established artists. And because now I cannot even think to afford any of their artworks. But I have, you know, artworks by reasonably successful contemporary Malaysian artists now.
Well, you're obviously, you know, a lot further down that path than I am, right?
Well, you know, it's a question of a personal interest. I was trying to get to the not so much the art aficionado question, but more the how can you buy art for somebody? How can you buy something that requires taste and match it to somebody else? I mean, you're going to have to kind of know them, I guess.
I guess it all depends on whether that person already has everything in life and you don't know what else to get him, you know, or her, and you get art.
Oh, you think art is the cherry on the icing, do you?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
I think art is necessary, as important as food. Okay, coming up after these messages, True Faith by New Order, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me, Tan Chung Han, and that was True Faith by New Order, taking you back to the 80s, a bit of a feel of the 80s, I believe, the New Order band there. We were talking about art, and I know it's piqued your interest, Han, yeah, so much so that we're going to continue talking about art, even as I try to tweet out the images of at least two of the artworks that have been named in the 1MDB saga. There were previous pieces, and that was a Monet essay, but this is what I'm going to tweet out, is a photographic work by Diane Arbus and a painting, an oil painting by Pablo Picasso.
And you can follow us on Twitter, that's at BFM Radio. So now, pursuant to our chat earlier, I did a quick Google search and I came across this report by Deloitte, and it's called Art and Finance. So they have an annual report focused on art and finance. And this is their 2016 report. And it's very, very fascinating. So obviously, like we mentioned earlier, this kind of asset class, it is an actual asset class. They call it collectibles. So that includes wine, classic cars, and obviously art pieces as well. So when you look at, say, the ultra high net worth,
individual
segment of society, right? And obviously that is a segment of society that Sharad, you and I have not yet.
Speak for yourself. Okay. I think I'm on the A-list.
No, really? I know. So apparently it's expected to see stunning growth by 2025. So so the total number of ultra wealthy individuals set to rise 41% from 2016 to 2025 to hit over 260,000 individuals. So you've got this growing market of people, who would then have an appetite, for these kind of collectibles.
Speaking of appetite and Joe Lo, I think what's clear is that I've read articles about this, is that there is a real material networking reason for buying high end art. I mean, art that's in the millions, which is you insinuate yourself into that class of people. You get a seat at the table when you buy a Picasso for $50 million US dollars or something like that.
Right.
So it is really about social mingling that, that's part of the impulse. Not to prejudge or to suggest that Joe Lo was doing that for those reasons. I mean, he could be a true lover of art. I think his classy yacht and all those images coming up from the parties they've had show him to be fairly classy.
Well, I guess besides those spillover effects, if you want to call it that, but nevertheless, the investment in the
spillover there, it's champagne, by the way. It's Cristal.
Oh, really good.
Not just any run-of-the-mill champagne.
But the investment in the art itself is something that is obviously gaining a lot of traction, so much so that, in case you didn't know, they have different indices that actually track these the value of art pieces. Oh. So, for example, you can check out the May Moses World All Art Index. So that spotted a 3.1% decline in 2015. You've also got an S&P Total Return Index. But mainly looking at the May Moses World All Art Index. Pretty fascinating there. So, besides the networking value and whatnot, buying your seat at the table, obviously, these asset classes in itself is something that's gaining a lot of attraction.
Yeah, and I think locally also galleries are doing a roaring business at art auctions. So art auctions also happening in the city. So all of it suggesting that, Han, if you haven't already missed the bandwagon, it's time that you jump on it quickly, Han.
Or start painting.
Okay.
Wow.
Coming up, we have the Seahorses and You Can Talk to Me, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Boys Don't Cry by The Cure. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Tan Chung Han, and it's time to continue that stretch. We're going to go all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning for you on The Morning Run. Now, we've had an announcement. It came out in my email about a bank, a certain bank, that is now going to have 1 month's paternity leave. It's announced this. And I thought that was extraordinary to sort of what would be an otherwise uneventful in-house HR policy change has become the subject of a kind of a public release. And I thought about it when I thought, oh, that's good, I guess. But, you know, what is that? What's going to happen during that month? Are fathers really co-sharing, you know, the responsibilities with their wives who just given birth? Or is it something, you know, or is it something that the bank wants to encourage in their staff that, you know, to think about gender equality and shared work?
Well, I certainly would like to think that the parents who are set to benefit from this, or the fathers who are set to benefit from this 1 month paid paternity leave, would, you know, indeed fulfill their paternal duties as opposed to going golfing and whatnot.
Yeah, going golfing, spending more time with your friends, no, and say, whoopee, I get a month off, you know.
No,
see you, wifey, you know.
Right. Again, I mean, the caveat here is that I am not a parent, but coming from a family of 9 kids and having seen my younger siblings grow up and, you know, the pains that my mom and also my dad, you know, went through in trying to raise all of us, yes, all 9 of us, you know, I think this is certainly a welcomed measure, right? Because obviously raising a child, especially a newborn child, is no easy task. It requires a whole village. It's not just the parents, but you got to get the in-laws involved as well. I mean, heck, even I had to be involved with raising my siblings as well. No?
Yeah.
So,
in fact, in your family's case, your nuclear family was a village.
Yeah.
All 11 of you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, football team. We were a football team. 9 kids and parents, done.
Okay, so I just want to ask this question. So is, you know, is this bank, and I understand that another local bank, you know, recently announced that we're going to extend maternity leave to up a year, mm-hmm. all of which basically is an attempt to retain your talent, right? You're making it easier for the people who work for you to remain within your organization while fulfilling responsibilities outside that organization. And so, but is it kind of like, you know, is it going ahead, and should we see policy in that fashion that it should actually be a step ahead of society, marking out new territory, new ways to think about things, or should policy reflect what actually is happening? Because you're always in danger that there will be those husbands who then take this month off to just enjoy themselves, because in their minds, you know, the early stages of having a child is essentially the mother's responsibility. I'm saying, I put all that all in quotes, because that is something that a lot of men kind of think. They just, and they say, well, it's natural. What, you know, I'm not involved in breastfeeding. Why, blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, so I guess it's a whole chicken egg scenario, right? So which one has to come first? Has the policy then shape the behavior? Or because there are these behaviors and or needs in society, then you adjust your policy accordingly, right? But I think in this instance, yeah, I mean, while there is, it exposes, you know, some elements of society to potentially abuse this policy, you know, as some of the cases you mentioned there. But I think nevertheless, the intent of this policy, I think, is very, I think it's comes from a good place, and I think it's necessary, right?
Okay, you know, Han, you, I imagine, I'm just looking at you, I know you're kind of garrulous, sort of, you know, social creature, so you must have lots of friends. Do you think among your male friends that this idea of shared domestic responsibility has already kicked in? It's
definitely, because again, you know, with the evolution of social expectations, you know, and very often you see how a lot more fathers many more fathers are getting involved with child rearing duties, and you post it up on social media as well, right? So when you've got other or your friends on social media who see that and they're saying, well, that's the standard now, you then have to emulate that when you do have kids, right? So let's say one new father has pictures of him, you know, spending quality time with the newborn, be it a fake picture or not, a manufactured moment or not. But nevertheless, you then want to replicate. There's that pressure, there's that social pressure for new fathers to then, you know, have those kind of involvement as well, right? So I think it's something that is very much expected of new fathers nowadays.
Yeah, and actually, if you travel around the region, you'll see that there are a lot of traditional societies where men do a lot of care, you know, and if they're carrying a child, it's the father that's carrying the child. Not so much here, I think, at least not among certain communities here, but certainly around the region. Fascinating images, making fatherhood really sexy and something you want to get into.
Oh, wow. I wouldn't go that far, but okay. Yeah.
Coming out after these messages, Paul McCartney and Jet, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Paul McCartney and Jet. I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run marches on as Emmanuel Macron's La République en Marche marches on, and we'll come back to that story later. We're going to be talking about something quite pertinent to all of us here, and especially those of us who have children and who are have children in school. The question of bullying, I think the discussions about that haven't abated since the brutal murders. We've had two young people brutally murdered over the last couple of weeks. And, you know, I think we're, you know, just to mention their names, Zulfahan, Osman Zulkarnain, as well as T. Naveen. Both deaths, you know, I think pricked the conscience of the public and really sent shivers, I think not just for parents, but I think for policymakers, because what do you do with such a situation? Now, we had the Prime Minister weigh in on this, and he says that people's morals, besides physical infrastructure, need to be developed. Now, it's interesting when politicians come out and say people's morals need to be developed. I always, my initial question, my default question is government in the position to, and is government the best agent to lead that charge on the question of morality?
Well, I wouldn't say they're the best, but are they important? I say absolutely, right? Because again, if you take a bottom-up approach and you see governments, the governments of the day as being the embodiment of the values and the you know, the standards that you uphold as a society, then they then have that, not just I think it's a moral responsibility on your behalf to then try to maintain those kind of values, right?
Okay, can you say that again? The government of the day is
if you subscribe to the bottom-up approach. So very often we hear, right?
Well, that's a top-down approach, meaning that the government... See, the thing is...
No, as in, like, very often you hear, you know, how it's like, oh, the leaders I guess you get the leaders you deserve, right? Yeah, you ever heard that phrase?
That kind of expression. Yeah, I think to the question of... and we come back to this over and over again, right? How do we view government? And, you know, we know that the impulses, especially in Asian governments... Leaders see themselves as being separate from the hoi polloi, separate from their citizens. They see themselves as special, and therefore they indulge in a kind of rhetoric or the language. You know, they like to exhort people to do this and that, make sacrifices for the nation, and, you know, be moral. These are exhortations, right? The question is, what kind of power and effect do these exhortations have in the world? So, is government the best?
Well, yeah, like I said, no, but very important.
So then who do we go to when we start to say, when we start to pass out the responsibilities between the different stakeholders in a society? Are we then looking to religious institutions or civic institutions to instill these values? Are we looking, we say, no, the primary focus must be in families. We need to empower families to make this. We need to teach parenting skills. We need to empower, or we say we empower children, for instance. Say the children have to learn to go or know where to go or step up to the plate when it comes to their own victimhood. I mean, so if they're being victimized, they should learn to kind of stand up for themselves.
I think, you know, obviously there are many, many stakeholders involved in this. I think this is safe to say this is a national dilemma right now, right? Especially in the wake of these tragic deaths, right? Because it's, well, in my personal opinion, I think it's got to start at home, right? It's those closest, these social agents who are closest to these children, right? So very often it's the family, parents, you know, and where that's lacking, then say the school or peer groups and, you know, religious leaders, community leaders and whatnot. Before going on to government, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of really important questions. I sometimes look to music and artists to kind of give me answers. This group, of course, does not inspire confidence in that terms, because it's called Ned's Atomic Dustbin. No, this song is coming after the ads before we go into the first, into the second bulletin of the morning. Not Sleeping Around, BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Shua Kutin, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run continues. As is the discussion about what to do with bullying, this because following the brutal murders of Zulfahan, Osman Zulkarnain and T. Naveen. In fact, Han, there is a online signature campaign. It's already got up to 30,000 signatures. And the petition of this, sorry, this online petition campaign, they're sending this petition to the United Nations, the federal as well as state governments to address school bullying. The petition was initiated by a computer engineering student, Mukesh Ravi. Now, Now, also in the mix, child activists are saying schools and parents must stop bullying. And the question, of course, is how. And so we asked Datin Azima from the Parent Action Group for Education, or PAGE as it's known, and we asked her if there are guidelines in place in schools to adhere to when addressing bullying.
I think that there is already some kind of protocol or SOP that schools have. It's a matter of enforcing it. But at the same time, I also think that there have been anti-bullying campaigns going on, but obviously it has not worked. So I think that we have to continue with this anti-bullying campaigns, but maybe it has to have a different twist, because if you ask students, they will say, yeah, we have this campaign in schools, but you know, they just have no impact on them. So we have to think about how we can get the attention of children.
So that was Datin Azima from PAGE, the Parent Action Group for Education, saying that there are steps, probably SOPs on bullying. In fact, there have been campaigns, but they've had little effect. Perhaps little effect on people who are potential victims, perhaps, or maybe they've had an effect on that group of kids, but they've certainly had no impact or maybe undiscernible impact on those who potentially become bullies. I mean, that's a very different thing, right? How do you persuade people not to be a criminal, not to be a bully, except by saying these would be the consequences? So all those kids who think, I'm so great, I'm a bully, I'm 15 and I'm tough, you know, now they're facing, potentially the gallows. And maybe that is a lesson for all of the true lesson for them.
Well, from the media reports that I've read of late, I think these five suspects will be spared from the gallows because they are age 18 and below, but they still could face imprisonment.
I'm not... Well, they're different cases, right? So I think there are some underage individuals.
For Tinavin's case.
Yeah. But Zulfahan, right. Osman, Zulkainen. But the point, I'm not an advocate of the death penalty, by the way.
Sure. But going back to what Datin Azima essentially said, I think she highlights a very key point here, whereby despite the anti-bullying campaigns that we have seen in Malaysian society over the years, it really hasn't gone about having that tangible effect, right? I mean think about it, how tangible can or how much traction can these kind of top-down, almost propaganda-esque campaigns really gain traction among society, right? I mean, if you look at, say, the anti-smoking campaign, despite pictures being put onto these cigarette boxes, yet has a smoking decline.
Increasing the price of cigarettes, I mean, because the under-the-table cigarettes are another issue, but, if you do increase the price, I mean, you can have effective policies. I'm thinking about this case, it's in the particular, the T9, case where apparently the bullies, as they call them, actually local thugs, and a case was lodged against them by somebody working in a 7-Eleven. Mm. It's just that that person then withdrew it. Now, if you kind of like talk to young people like this, and especially from that kind of social milieu, you know they often have backing. So they might be 15, right, but they have an elder brother who's in a gang or is another local toughie, and they can always call upon them. And if you remember, with Atid Navin's friend, he's already been getting phone calls, threatening phone calls. So the question is, why didn't the police go after these guys? I mean, it comes back to that really brutal question of what do we do with gangs, especially because it's tied up with urban poverty and all those other difficult questions. Okay, let's leave that aside and just criminality. What about what schools can do? Is it about empowering kids, do you think?
Yeah, I think the peer group plays a much more crucial role in this context, perhaps than, say, teachers. Again, because, once you get to the teenage levels, the stereotype is that they are trying to find their identity. There is this anti-authority undertone that is very prevalent among teens, right? So I think having the teachers being made this scapegoat of sorts as like why they didn't really nip this in the bud, I think that's a bit misplaced, because there's so many other factors that go towards pushing someone towards either gangsterism or bullying, right?
Okay, but what about this whole attitude that kids need to be tough? And so if a kid comes to you and say, I've been bullied, what what are the chances that some adult will say, look, you can, it's not such a big issue, you can solve it on your own.
Right.
And this is what kids do. I mean, there's a kind of attitude among parents that kind of, or adults that dismiss the problem, you know, because they think it's just what kids do.
Right. I mean, now, obviously, this would have to be judged on a case-by-case basis, right? Now, obviously, the tragic incident with Tina Vin was an extreme, right? I mean, surely we do not hope that, I mean, obviously, this is not the norm, and I hope it doesn't become the norm, right? But I think going back to the day-to-day operations of a school, though, I mean, keep in mind, teachers are just so bogged down with the responsibilities of having to impart the curriculum, making sure that they meet, manage expectations, not just of the students, but of the parents and the headmasters and the ministry and whatnot. There's so much place on them. You can't expect them to be, what, helicopter teachers now, right, where they can shadow every single troubled kid, so to speak. You know, you just don't have the resources for that. And so then back to the question, right, what do you do? Does the peer group play a more important role? Because obviously they spend a lot more time with their peers than, say, an authority figure, right?
Okay, so we're looking at, I mean, broadly speaking, we're looking at mitigation, we're looking at providing, you know, access to justice. I mean, right, so it's like crime. We all want policies that will eliminate crime, but we know crime continues because of the nature of society and, in fact, maybe the nature of people, right? And maybe bullying is just part of that spectrum of criminal activity that in some instances goes beyond the norm and results in death. We can look at specific institutions, and I think of, say, hostels, right? Those institutions where young men, and it's often young men, but the women also, there are instances of bullying among girls where, you know, they're all bunched together and they form their own social hierarchies. We know this. Yep. I mean, just read William Golding's Lord of the Flies. You know, and this got a bit of classic literature for you there, Han, so early in the morning, which is that kids do create these social hierarchies because they're mimicking society.
There you go.
They're mimicking society. There is nothing, in some sense, extraordinary about what kids do when they bully others, because we see this all the time. There's a huge amount of bullying that goes on in public life. You know, we see it in our politics. We see it in our society. We know people use all kinds of ways to differentiate themselves from each other. Sometimes it's violent.
Right, exactly. And it's not just mimicking what they see in real life in society, but also what they are subjected to, and I use that term, subjected to, like, say, in the media, right? When they see antagonists that are portrayed in movies and TV shows and whatnot, and they seek to emulate them, then what? I mean, so do you have policies that, say, heighten the level of censorship in trying to stem those kind of influences from the media? So it's a very, very complicated
affair. I'm certainly not an advocate, or I wouldn't support any form of censorship. I think the idea is to empower young people
to make it age appropriate, though, at least.
Yeah, okay. So if we treated adults like adults in our censorship, rather than treat everybody like by default as a child, right, you know, and with the state playing the role of parent, yes, I believe in that. But, you know, I mean, I don't believe in that, and I think that that's clearly what's happening now. But it's a really prickly question, but it's unfortunate that the death of these two boys is, you know, really leading us down this murky road, and I think we need much, much more clarity as we go forward. But going forward, we'll be back with more business and political analysis on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.